The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the series on Mormonism for the New Books Network. I'm your host, Daniel Stone, and I have a terrific guest tonight. It's Larry Morris, and we're going to talk about his brand new book called A Documentary History of the Book of Mormon. It's published by Oxford University Press. It's come out this year. It's a fantastic book, and I'm just so excited to have Larry on the show. So, Larry, thank you so much for being on. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Daniel. I appreciate being here.
Thanks. So, Larry, just to kind of jump into it, could you just let us know a little bit about yourself, like your background, what you've published in the past?
Oh, you bet. I was born and raised in Idaho Falls, Idaho. And I attended college at Brigham Young University. I have a bachelor's in philosophy and a master's in American literature. And I was very interested in writing fiction in those early days. And the first things that I published were short stories, and I published a novel in the 1980s with Signature Books.
Very cool.
But as I was writing fiction, I got more and more interested in writing historical fiction. And eventually, about 20 years ago, I became very interested in trying my hand at a narrative nonfiction and started working on two different kinds of history, Mormon history, especially the early history of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon and the founding of the church. And I was also interested especially in Lewis and Clark. So I kind of started doing research on both of those topics. And around 2000, I started publishing articles on both Mormon history and the history of Lewis and Clark. And I might add that my wife Deborah and I live in Salt Lake City. We have 4 children and 8 grandchildren. And she's a second grade school teacher.
Oh, nice. So, and I mean, I think you're being modest. You're an award-winning historian for Lewis and Clark. Is that correct? I mean, you've published quite a bit on it.
Yes, I have. I got really quite interested in it, and especially in what became of the Lewis and Clark party after the expedition. And I published first articles on that subject, and then I published a book called The Fate of the Core with Yale University Press. And I got a lot of opportunities to speak in 2004, the year the book was published, because that was kind of the 200th anniversary of the beginning of the Lewis and Clark expedition. So I've really enjoyed both kinds of research, and the Lewis and Clark research kind of naturally evolved into research on the early fur trade, because several of the Lewis and Clark folks came back west as fur traders.
Okay.
So for all these years, I've kind of juggled back and forth between Mormon history and early Western history, and I just really enjoyed both of them.
Nice. Yeah, well, it seems like a good stepping stone to kind of jump into Mormon history, especially studying Lewis and Clark and the expedition out west. I mean, you're kind of getting that foundation of American history and how the nation in general is just expanding culturally, I mean, just geographically. So how did you get involved? So you said you went to BYU. I'm assuming you were raised in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So then how did you get involved with the Joseph Smith Papers Project, and how did you kind of jump into Mormon history? Was Lewis and Clark like a stepping stone to that, or were you always interested in Mormon history your whole life?
I wasn't. You know, at the time I was attending college, like I said, I was interested in literature and philosophy and kind of toyed with the idea of getting a PhD in philosophy. But I ended up going into editing. I was an editor for my career. I technically retired a few years ago. And I don't remember which I got interested in first, church history or Lewis and Clark, but about the same time. And of course, you're dealing with a very similar time period, since Joseph Smith was born during the Lewis and Clark expedition. You know, he was born in 1805, and Lewis and Clark left St. Louis in 1804, and they returned in 1806. So I think kind of the fact that the time period was very similar just made those two research topics very compatible.
Yeah, it seems like it. And how did you get involved with the Joseph Smith Papers Project?
Like I said, I was working in the editing field, and I was in the computer industry for about 18 years. And in 2002, I applied for an opening at the Neil A. Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship at Brigham Young University and got a job as an editor. And so I got seriously into Mormon history at that point. And eventually, I got very interested in the Joseph Smith Papers. You know, the first article I published on Mormon history dealt with Oliver Cowdery, who was one of the three witnesses of the Book of Mormon. And that was even before I got my job at BYU. So I had that interest, and I kind of continued doing research on Oliver Cowdery and the early history of the Book of Mormon. And the Joseph Smith Papers just fit so well with that interest that I believe it was in 2006, I applied for a job at the Joseph Smith Papers and got that job. And so it just fit in with all of the research, both personally and professionally, that I'd been doing for the previous few years.
Okay. Very cool. Yeah. And you know, this book that you've just published, A Documentary History of the Book of Mormon, it's phenomenal. It's just as good as anything that's published by the Joseph Smith Papers Project, in my opinion. It's very thorough. It's an excellent read. You've done a great job editing it, and I love your historical introductions for every single document that you include within it. It really seems that the Joseph Smith Papers was the background to publish this book, and I'm just assuming. Is that correct?
That's absolutely true. Yes. I really enjoyed working on the Joseph Smith Papers, and they've got an amazing team of historians. And they're for any given document, as you know, they'll have an historical introduction, and then they'll have extensive footnotes that really help you understand both the documents themselves and the historical setting for those documents. And I really loved that work, and I admired that the work the historians there were doing. And so, and since I already had this interest in the early history of the Book of Mormon, all of those things meshed so well that after I retired from the Joseph Smith Papers, I really wanted to do that same kind of work. So my documentary history follows kind of the same methodology and the same format as the Joseph Smith papers. And so even though I had retired from the church officers, the church history library, I felt like I was doing very similar work and really enjoying it, just like I had at the Joseph Smith papers.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, so I had another question. So the Joseph Smith papers covers a lot of, you know, the early days of the publication of the Book of Mormon, and obviously it goes on further. But I really liked your book. I mean, first of all, it's phenomenal because you got Oxford to publish it. So first of all, that just goes to show how good it is. But second of all, you really had just honed in specifically on the on basically Joseph Smith finding the golden plates and the publication of the Book of Mormon. And this book is a meaty book. I mean, I wanted to ask, it just seems to me that there's a lot of information in this book that might not necessarily be in the Joseph Smith papers, correct? So somebody might not say to you like, oh, well, a lot of this stuff's already covered in the Joseph Smith papers, so why would you publish a separate book? I mean, you really did a lot more extensive work within this work, correct?
Yes, of course, part of that is because of the nature of the Joseph Smith papers. They consider, when they defined, quote, Joseph Smith papers, they included anything that Joseph himself wrote. They included letters and other documents that were directed to him, documents that he, legal documents or church administration documents that mention him. And they include histories, for example, that he did not write himself, but he commissioned other people to write. So there's quite a number of important documents that just by the very nature are not included in the Joseph Smith papers. For example, Joseph Smith's mother, Lucy Mack Smith, wrote a wonderful memoir of the Smith family. And it's quite a crucial research for early church history, but it is not included in the Joseph Smith papers because it's not something that was commissioned by Joseph Smith. It was written after his death, and that's just a good example of a very crucial source that is not included in the Joseph Smith papers. And so I included things like many of the Joseph Smith neighbors gave affidavits in 1834, kind of talking of their experience with the Smith family. And of course, those are not included in the Joseph Smith papers, but I think they're very relevant to a history of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. So I include quite a number of documents that are not in the Joseph Smith papers.
Yeah. And it was there was a lot of new stuff in there I had never even read or heard of before. I'm assuming I don't know if you've heard anybody from the outside, just or from scholars within Mormon studies. I'm assuming that would be their knowledge as well. The breadth of what your book has covered is pretty impressive. I mean, how did you find all this documentation? Like, where did you know to look?
Well, the two key sources I immediately went to were Dan Vogel's early Mormon documents. He has 5 volumes. I had purchased those as they came out. They started coming out in the early 1990s, if I remember correctly. And for several years, every few years, there would be a new volume of early Mormon documents. And of course, he covers more than just the Book of Mormon, but his research is really amazing. And so that was a key resource for me. The Joseph Smith papers themselves was a key resource. And then looking at biographies of Joseph Smith and just kind of reviewing my research, I've been doing serious research since the late 1990s when I went to Vermont and did the Oliver Cowdery research, you know. And so just my personal files, early Mormon documents, Joseph Smith papers, and kind of the I tried to keep up with the articles that had been published the last several years and the key books. And so once you get rolling, then you frequently find something in someone's bibliography that turns out to be valuable, and that'll lead you to something else. And so you're kind of hopping from one thing to another. And then at some point, you kind of have to try and get systematic about it. But that was kind of how I came up with the documents that I wanted to include.
Nice. It sounds like a treasure hunt.
It was fun. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah. So how did you decide what to include? Or, and were there times where you kind of were on the fence of what to include and what not to include?
First of all, I wanted to get firsthand documents. So, for example, when, Emma Smith's father, Isaac Hale, was opposed to Emma's marriage to Joseph Smith, and he never converted to Mormonism, was always skeptical of Joseph Smith, but he left a firsthand document talking about his experience with Joseph, and to me, that's a perfect example of the kind of source I wanted, because he was on the scene. He's not getting these things secondhand. He's talking about his personal experiences with Joseph Smith. And he recorded his statement in 1834, which is relatively easy. So, I mean, relatively early. So, for me, the most important documents were firsthand documents that were created close to the time of the event itself. And that includes hostile statements from neighbors of the Smiths or from neighbors of Isaac Hale down in Pennsylvania. And it also includes statements from people who believed Joseph Smith. And good examples of that would be Lucy Mack Smith, his mother, and the three witnesses, David Whitmer, Oliver Cowdery, and Martin Harris. So that was my first priority, was to get those kinds of statements. And then I also wanted to get what I considered important secondhand statements from people who may have gotten their information not from Joseph, but from someone else. So there are statements from people who didn't talk to Joseph personally, but they talked to Joseph Smith Sr. There are statements from people who didn't talk to Joseph, but talked to Lucy Mack Smith, or they may have talked to Martin Harris. So you kind of consider those secondhand witnesses of what Joseph himself claimed to have experienced. And I would always rank these by these categories, whether or not they were first or second hand or even third hand, and also when that statement or that article or whatever it was first published or recorded, going from the earlier to the later. So we have in the book documents as early as 1828 and as late as the 1930s. When people who talked directly to Martin Harris, one of the three witnesses, recorded their account of that event in the 1930s. So it covers quite a spectrum. And when I, so those criteria had a lot to do with what documents I used and which documents I rejected. Then you also deal with the fact that someone like David Whitmer, he gave many interviews about his experience as one of the three witnesses. And of course, there's a volume published, which is strictly, that's all it contains are David Whitmer interviews. So there I couldn't include very many of those at all. So I tried to find some representative examples when I knew that a single person had given several different accounts. And I proposed to, after Oxford University Press expressed interest in the book, I kind of did a rough estimate of how many words I thought would be suitable, both for the length of the book and to try and cover the material, you know. And I proposed a book to Oxford that was 250,000 words long, and they accepted that idea. So from that point on, I also had that in mind, and it worked out fine. I thought that was about the right length. So I didn't really have any major conflicts of having to exclude certain documents that I thought were important. It all worked out, and I felt quite good about what was finally published in the book.
Wonderful. Yeah, I really appreciated how you included sources from all different walks of life, people that believed, people who didn't believe. And it was really interesting reading both sides of the, you know, both sides of the coin and over time. And what I really liked about your book, and I thought, you know, I really appreciate you talking about, you know, your mindset and the methodology behind putting this book together, because to me, that's always really fascinating, are the nuts and bolts of how people actually, you know, think about books before they start writing. I mean, really, that's the crux of authors and, you know, their work. And it's often things that we don't talk about. Yeah. So I really appreciate you talking about it. But another thing I appreciated about your book was that you talked about the struggle and the difficulty it is dealing with. I mean, most religions are grassroots religions, right? But Mormonism is certainly no exception. It's a grassroots religion. There aren't a lot of primary sources specifically during that time frame. It's not like Joseph Smith was walking around and the people that were walking around with him recording every single thing that was happening, especially as the public, you know, especially when Joseph Smith is receiving these angelic visitations, especially very early on in the religion. A lot of these documents, as you had brought out, were much later on. And can you kind of go into that a little bit and just kind of the difficulty, but also the treasure troves of history in general and how religious history has that difficulty?
You know, as I worked on the book, the thing that surprised me the most was that for a very crucial time period from September of 1823 to September of 1827, this was when Joseph said that he received the visits from the angel Moroni, who informed him of the gold plates, and eventually he obtained those plates and translated them to produce the Book of Mormon. For that crucial time period of 1823 to 1827, there is not a single extant document that mentions the Book of Mormon. Now, to me, that was just amazing. In Lewis and Clark terms, it would be similar to Lewis and Clark taking their trip west and then getting back and not producing any documents about the expedition until the expedition was done. To me, that would be the fitting parallel. And of course, in Lewis and Clark scholarship, the key source for historians are the journals kept by Lewis and Clark and three or four of the men during the expeditions. Those are an invaluable primary source. And for the Book of Mormon, you don't have anything for a crucial period of Book of Mormon history. So that's the first difficulty any historian of Mormonism faces, is that you have plenty of people who talked about that time period later on, you know, in the 1830s and for several decades thereafter. People would give their reminiscences of what happened during those 4 years, but not a single document that was created during that period that survived. So with both those who were hostile to Joseph Smith and those who were friendly to him, you have the problem that by the time they recorded their reminiscence, their memory had already been colored by the events that had happened in the meantime. And so that's a kind of a historical difficulty that any historian has dealing with this time period, how you're going to make judgments. And then starting in, really, in 1828, there's very little that I was able to include in my book. But starting in 1829, you start getting a lot of documents related to the Book of Mormon. For example, the Book of Mormon was not published until March of 1830. But in 1829, starting in June and going through the rest of that calendar year, newspaper articles about the Book of Mormon started appearing. And you start having people attempting to describe the contents of the book. And quite a number of newspaper columnists were mocking the book but no one had had the opportunity to actually read the Book of Mormon during that period. So now you're dealing with newspaper articles and statements by onlookers regarding the Book of Mormon before it's even published. And then, of course, over the next few years after the Book of Mormon was published, you have quite a wealth of information dealing with the Book of Mormon, which is very important. So you go from having nothing there at the beginning, in 1823, for example, you have no source material at all, but in 1829, you have quite a bit. And by 1880, you have people like many neighbors have recorded their reminiscences, Lucy Mack Smith, William Smith, that's Joseph Smith's younger brother, and quite a host of people who over the years recorded reminiscences about those key years. So a lot of things to deal with in deciding which documents are more authoritative than others. And I think that's where it's important, anytime you have a document, to compare it to other documents that you have and see what those, for example, a person hostile to Joseph Smith and a person friendly to Joseph Smith may have made certain claims that were similar. And to me, that's worth a lot to have both of those types of witnesses say the same thing. But if you have a person who says something that no one else corroborates, then I think there's reason to be skeptical of it. So during the research and compilation of all these documents, there were quite a few opportunities where it was important to evaluate the sources and see which sources I felt were most authoritative. And that was always an effort at historiography and really didn't depend on whether those documents were favorable or not favorable toward Joseph Smith himself.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you touched on something that I wanted to ask you. You know, because you have so many different sources from, you know, different people, believers, non-believers alike, what were some of the similarities and differences that you noticed between them? Did you find anything that surprised you?
One thing that's interesting is that many of the neighbors did believe that Joseph Smith had plates. Now, part of the history of this is that during this, during the early 1800s in both upstate New York and throughout New England, there was a lot of treasure seeking going on. And people were searching for such treasure as gold or silver mines, and they were also searching for the kind of treasure that might have been left behind by pirates or others who had obtained some kind of wealth, coins, for example, and had buried their treasure somewhere. So there's all kinds of treasure seeking going on, and throughout the area, there were seers who used stones or divining rods or some other artifact to help search for treasure. And this was common throughout New England and New York. And Michael Quinn points out, he's a Mormon historian, quite prominent, who points out that in the area of New York, upstate western New York, where the Smith family lived, virtually every village had one or more seers who helped people search for treasure. And the young Joseph Smith was one of those seers. He used a stone to help his father and some of the neighbors search for treasure. And some of the neighbors felt that when they heard the story of Joseph Smith discovering gold plates, they felt like a share of the wealth that would come from these plates belonged to them, because they had kind of been partners, so to speak, out searching for treasure with the Smith family. And David Whitmer learned about the plates. He lived about 30 miles away in Fayette, New York. In 1829, he was in Palmyra, near the Smith home, just on farming business, and he started hearing about these gold plates, and he went out to interview some of these. He got interested in this and went out and talked to some of the Smith neighbors, and that was basically what they told him, was that Joseph Smith had been involved with them in searching for treasure, and now he had discovered these plates, and they felt like they should share in the wealth. And so from the start, the neighbors are not, the neighbors that did not believe Joseph Smith's story about the angel were still open to the idea that he had indeed discovered gold plates and that those plates were valuable. So there's not a great deal of skepticism among the neighbors about whether Joseph had plates or not. Many of them assumed that he did. Of course, they probably thought that he just found those digging for treasure rather than being visited by an angel. And of course, those who converted to Mormonism, they believed that Joseph Smith had been visited by an angel who directed him to the plates. But you do have that thing in common, that both the hostile neighbors and the believers kind of acknowledged that there were gold plates. And of course, the fact that Joseph Smith had used his seer stone to search for treasure, for many of the neighbors, this was just proof to them that his having plates didn't have anything to do with religion or with Jesus Christ, but really was just part of his treasure seeking. And those who joined the Mormon Church after it was organized in April of 1830 believed that Joseph Smith had been directed from an angel from 1823, and also believed that he had had earlier visions. So they see it from quite a religious perspective. And Isaac Hale was a good example of a person who was skeptical from the start, really didn't think there was much to this treasure-seeking idea. And Joseph Smith Sr. and Jr. had stayed in the Hale home when they were searching for treasure in 1825. And he was a good representative of the people who believed that Joseph Smith's treasure seeking had evolved into kind of a religious idea, but they didn't think there was anything to it. So that's a very interesting dynamic.
Yeah. Another point, I love what you're talking about, because another thing that I really enjoyed about your book, and it really highlights it, and you're bringing it out now fully, is this idea. I mean, the Book of Mormon is a cultural artifact, and it might sound weird to say that, because the gold plates, nobody has seen them, right? I mean, like you said, other than the witnesses that Joseph Smith showed them to, or the three witnesses that saw them through, you know, through a vision, nobody has seen, or in the few other people that got to see it that your book points out, nobody has actually seen these plates. They don't exist anymore in the sense that, you know, people can't touch them. You know, Joseph Smith says that he gave them back to the angel. But what you're pointing out is that people genuinely believe that he had gold plates, whether they saw it in religious terms or not. And there was a product that came out of those gold plates, which was the Book of Mormon. And it was this actual book. So, you know, a lot of other, you know, religious texts, you know, like, for instance, like you think of the Quran, you know, it's a dictation by an angel. Well, Joseph Smith actually says, like, no, he actually has something physical. And then this holy text comes out of that. So what I really liked about your book was you really show that the Book of Mormon is a hidden cultural artifact, if that makes any sense, where it doesn't exist anymore. But yet look at the impact that these, you know, gold plates, quote unquote, had on American history and just, you know, Mormonism in general.
Yes, because really the Book of Mormon was the key event in the founding of Mormonism. And it was as I mentioned, the Book of Mormon was published just a few weeks before the church was organized. And it was an important missionary tool. You had so many people who joined the church because they read and believed in the Book of Mormon. And then, of course, the Mormonism turned out to be such an important religion in American history, with the saints going west and taking such an important role in westward settlement. So the Book of Mormon really is crucial to that subsequent history.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to ask you something else, Larry. So now that you've done all this research and you've been doing it, you know, for several years, and this is part of your career, in your opinion, why has the Book of Mormon been a book of intrigue and controversy for almost 200 years? I mean, it's been almost 200 years and we're still talking about it. I mean, there's so many books being published on the Book of Mormon. Mormon Studies is really growing. Oxford University Press, which again, your book is published under, they have published, they're kind of now one of the major foundational publishers of, you know, Mormon Studies, and they produce great books. So why is there so much intrigue on the Book of Mormon and Mormonism? And why is there still so much controversy about this book?
I think there are two reasons, among others, that strike me. And one is that Joseph Smith claimed to have a physical artifact associated with the book, you know, kind of the primary text, which was the plates. So that put the Book of Mormon kind of in a separate category than other writings that were inspired, you know, believed to have been inspired by God. And second is that rather than just claiming that the Book of Mormon contained important religious truths, Joseph Smith claimed that it was historical in the sense that Moroni, the angel who appeared and informed Joseph Smith of the plates and who was one of the authors of those plates, gives a historical tie where basically the Book of Mormon itself insists that it is a real history of some of the inhabitants of this continent. So I think the artifact itself and the fact that it claims a historicity have made it very controversial and interesting to people. And so you have, on both sides of the issue, you have people who raise objections to the the claimed historicity of the Book of Mormon, and those who claim support for the idea, and both sides do extensive research and are quite convinced that their position is true. So you've got that controversy, and then you've got the fact that so many people have been converted to a form of Mormonism, whether it's the Community of Christ or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or some of the other religions. It was reading the Book of Mormon that helped convince them of the truth of the religion. So there's really a lot going on there, and I think the Book of Mormon is kind of unique in that regard in American history.
Yeah. It's almost like, I mean, I know it's been talked about quite a bit, but it really is the American Bible. I mean, there's really no other equivalent.
Sure. You bet.
Very interesting. So while you were working on this book, was there anything that you weren't expecting to find or something that really shocked you or surprised you? I mean, because there was quite a bit for me while I was reading it. But for you, I mean, you were really in the nitty gritty with the Joseph Smith papers. Did you find anything while putting the book together that really kind of surprised you or shocked you?
Well, as I mentioned, one thing that really surprised me was that there weren't any documents in that 1823 to 1827 time period. And then the other thing that surprised me was that Joseph Smith himself wrote so little. There's so little that's recorded in his handwriting. To me, that's surprising because there are so many histories of the church. Several histories that Joseph himself commissioned and asked to be done, but he did not do them himself. And you had people like John Whitmer and John Corll back in the 1830s who were both assigned to do histories. And then, of course, the history of the church, part of which has been canonized in the Pearl of Great Price, which is a volume of scripture that's held by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so there have been many, quote, histories of the church, but very little actually written in Joseph Smith's hand. So you immediately have a difficulty there of trying to understand how these histories were produced and who actually did the writing. And let me point out, let me grab a book here. There's a very good source on this, a great book that I recommend, and it's called Foundational Texts of Mormonism, Examining Major Early Sources, edited by Mark Ashurst McGee, Robin Scott Jensen, and Sherilyn Howcroft. And it has a number of essays on the kind of the essential primary documents of Mormonism and how they were produced. And I think that book is a great way of understanding how the present attitude toward Mormon history and the present work being done by scholars, how that was all shaped by these early texts.
Yeah. One thing, again, another thing your book brings out is it goes to show you how elusive the historical craft actually is. It's not a hard science in the fact that, I mean, like you said, there's a lot of bias, there's a lot of weighing of sources, and historians basically just have to do the best they can with what they have at the time. And
You bet. I think that's very true. That's exactly what you do. You do your best with what you have, you know? And every primary document has something missing, something you wish they had said, or it has some contradiction with another primary document. Now, let me give you a good example from the Lewis and Clark world. And this was, as I said, this was an event where Lewis and Clark and about four other members of the expedition were keeping daily journals. But of course, they didn't necessarily record right on the spot. Sometimes we know from people who have really studied this that sometimes they recorded their, quote, daily entry later. So you immediately have that problem. But early in the expedition, John Coulter, who later became a famous explorer after the expedition, he was out hunting, and he afterwards, he had this encounter with Lakota Indians in present South Dakota, and they almost, Lewis and Clark and the Indians almost engaged in a battle where many on both sides could have been killed. And the various journalists kept a record of what happened that day, and some of them just mentioned a hunter who had been out hunting, and some of them mentioned Coulter by name, but when it came to the results of his hunt, none of the journalists agreed. One would say he killed two elk. One would say he killed an elk and a deer. One would say he killed two deer and an elk, that kind of thing. So you have four different versions. And these are people who are well acquainted and know the difference between a deer and an elk. And they were on the scene. And yet, on that detail, their accounts don't agree. And that's exactly the situation any historian is looking at when they attempt to get at, quote, what happened. It is very elusive. And it's challenging, you know, it's fun.
Yeah. And then with your book, you just throw religion into that as well. And that just complicates things as more. And I appreciate it. In your introduction, you had even talked about that. You had said, you know, you weren't here to talk about, you know, to whether like faith promote or to, you know, to faith bash. You just wanted to present the sources. You didn't want to kind of weigh things one way or the other. You're just going to present them as they were, give good historical introductions. And I really appreciated that. I mean, I see this book as a major primer for anybody who's going to do, basically anybody who's going to write about the Book of Mormon now, they have to reference your book. They just can't ignore it. And it's a huge service that you've done for scholars that want to study early Mormonism and the Book of Mormon. I mean, it's just, there's no way they can't reference your book anymore. So thank you for doing that.
Oh, I really appreciate that. And, you know, I don't think it's the role of the historian to make a conclusion about the truth of a religious claim. Because especially, you know, when we're talking about revelation and angels, for example, that is not really something that the historian documents. It's a religious activity to document that experience. And I believe that the historian deals with empirical realities. And so when Joseph Smith talks about seeing an angel, that's a personal religious experience that the historian really cannot evaluate in terms of empirical values, since seeing an angel is not part of common human experience. I think it lies in the area of religion rather than in the area of history, that claim about seeing an angel. Whereas the role of the historian is to document what Joseph said and what other people on the scene said. But I believe concluding whether or not Joseph actually saw an angel is a personal religious matter, and I don't believe historians, I don't believe it's their role to make a judgment on that.
Yeah.
And I would add, now, if we have evidence of a person claiming to see an angel and we think they're guilty of fraud, or we think there was mental illness involved or hallucination or anything like that, I think that's fair game for the historian if the historian has solid empirical testimony, relating to that.
Yeah.
So there's no doubt that as soon as you bring in, you know, it's hard enough with Lewis and Clark, but as soon as you bring in religion, then you're really dealing with some tremendous difficulties in trying to write a history of the period.
Yeah. This is fascinating, Larry. I really appreciate you letting me pick your brain on this. We are getting a glimpse of how you put this book together and just on the Book of Mormon history in general. So thank you.
Oh, you bet.
So, you know, again, I just want to let the listeners know we're talking with Larry Morris, who've published this great documentary history called A Documentary History of the Book of Mormon, published by Oxford University Press. Again, it's a great book. Definitely should get it if you're interested in the Book of Mormon. It is one of the foundational books now. It is like I said, I don't think scholars can overlook this book. And Larry did most of the work for us, thankfully. I mean, all those primary documents are right there, ready for people to look at. He's got these great historical introductions. It's just the bibliography, everything's just phenomenal, the sources. So thank you, Larry, for doing that.
Oh, thanks very much.
So, Larry, before I let you go tonight, what information, or I want to say, like, what information or what research are you working on now, and what can we expect to learn from you in the near future?
Well, now I'm working on a narrative history rather than a documentary history, and I'm dealing with some Mormon pioneers during the 1800s The book I have planned, I haven't written it yet, but the book I'm planning and researching would start around 1810 and end around 1890, so it covers most of the 19th century. And I'm not quite ready to announce that. I like to have an agreement with a publisher before I go public with plans to do a book.
Okay.
In fact, once I did have a contract for a book about John Coulter, and I announced that publicly, and it never developed. At least that one didn't. Later on, I co-authored a book about Coulter, but the one that I had signed the contract for didn't develop. So I like to be a little careful about announcing things, you know?
Okay, well, you're leaving us on a cliffhanger, so that's good. Well, Larry, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. Again, it's a documentary history of the Book of Mormon, a fantastic book. And Larry, just really appreciate you talking with us. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate being asked.
Take care.
Thanks a lot. Bye.